Welcome to the Mormon News Report podcast for the week of September 18th, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With a fabulous sprinkling of snark on top of your Mormon cake.
Whoa. Bram, bring it back. Let's not get into this just yet. We've still got to do the introductions.
Okay, fine. But listen, Brian, I'm going to warn you. I'm ready to go today. Okay, hey, so let's get it.
Feisty Brant is the best Brant. But listen, folks, we've got a great show lined up for you today. Max Perry Mueller will be joining us to talk about his new book, Race and the Making of the Mormon People, from the University of North Carolina Press.
Now, look, guys, I know that we say that these books are all great books, and I'm going to forewarn you, one of the reasons why we have these people on is because we want to find really quality books. But not only was this book great, it was also another great addition to this growing collection of scholarly books that are on Mormonism and their complicated history with race. But the research that Max did on Jane Manning James was excellent. And hey, do you guys want to hear some more about it? You should definitely become a supporter on Patreon, where the Mormon News Report extended sessions, where you're going to hear some juicy bits on Jane Manning James, are available to subscribers for just $1 a month. Your $1 or more gets you access to our conversations with guests that get a little looser, and we conveniently drop some choice nuggets.
Yeah, it's our little gift to you, our supporters, for helping us provide you with the best coverage, commentary, analysis, and a sprinkling of snark to breaking Mormon news.
Guys, it's simple. Just head over to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a Patreon subscriber today.
And there's many other ways that you can help support us. A review on iTunes goes a long way in helping our search rankings. A share on Facebook or retweet on Twitter, those also help out.
Y'all, I'm going to go ahead and call you out, okay? We could use another really good review. We've only had one so far, and we could use more. Really, don't make me use a commitment pattern on you.
You mean the old missionary commitment pattern?
Oh, yeah. Brother or sister, insert your name here. Will you write a review for the Mormon News Report on iTunes by next Monday? We will be following up with each and every one of you to see if you followed through, and we will be checking up, kind of, throughout the week.
Ah, the good old will you. Well, Brant, on with the news.
All right. Brian, guess what? The Mormons are coming to town.
Oh, tell me, Brant, is this a situation where I need to lock the doors and keep my children and pets indoors?
Well, if it's because you're sensitive to classical music and choirs, then yes. The Motab announced their West Coast tour this week for 2018, where the choir will be holding concerts along the West Coast from South Carolina to Vancouver, British Columbia.
The choir is going to be touring from June 18th to July 3rd, with tickets available for the 2018 tour on December 1st through MormonTabernacleChoir.org.
Let me tell you, guys, you thought the Hall & Oates groupies were wild? You won't even be ready when the Mormons roll into town.
And I hear that there's going to be unlimited juice and cookies.
We have unlimited juice? This party is going to be off the hook.
Moving on. Brian, you know, I don't want to gloat.
But
I'm going to gloat. Guys, I told you, all you BYU fans, not to expect too much last week in your Holy War game. And this week, BYU hoped to bounce back against number 10 Wisconsin.
Which, well, yeah, didn't really happen. But it does bring up the weirdest column that we've read in a long while, which is saying something considering how much we actually do read. Yes, Matt Brown wrote a piece for SB Nation with the title, "Wisconsin Fans Drink a Lot. BYU's Town Has Almost No Bars. Something's Gotta Give."
I mean, Brian, listen, some people have normal hobbies, okay? Like golfing or hiking. And some like to collect stamps. We track Mormon news, and then there's hobbies like this.
So buckle up, folks. We're doing math. Wisconsinites, they like to drink. On average, they're about 13% more grocery stores than bars nationally. In Wisconsin, they're about 2.7 times the number of bars than there are grocery stores.
And I think you all know where this is going. In Provo, Utah, there appear to be two bars. Yes, two. This excludes places like Chili's where you can grab a beer, or liquor stores or grocery stores or private clubs or bars at hotels, okay? Just Provo and just bars. Brown found two of them, the City Limits Bar and AGB's Libation Emporium.
And Libation Emporium, that sounds like something that a Mormon would call it if they didn't want to refer to it as a bar. Spoiler alert, while the piece doesn't exactly do the math like they claim, here was the best quote from the owner of the Libation Emporium. "Look, if it's on TV, it's on TV, but we're not going to put on a specific game because then the college kids, they come in here and they drink waters and they don't buy anything. We have 53 flavors of beer and probably the largest liquor selection in Utah Valley outside of your Jack Mormon uncle."
And you know, despite the fact that the comment sections on most websites are basically the absolute dirt worst, this one did stand out. Well, if they feel the need to spoil the family-friendly atmosphere and dull their senses with a toxic substance rather than enjoying what should be a fun competitive football game, I guess that's their choice. I'll pray for them.
And don't forget my personal favorite. Anyone who says 53 flavors of beer does not quite understand the level of boozing that is heading to town.
Don't worry, everybody. There will be extra security at the BYU Creamery to crowd manage the hordes of dads wearing their BYU national champion shirt that they've worn every Saturday since 1984 and still arguing that Robbie Bosco was robbed in the 1985 Heisman Trophy Awards because what did that Bo Jackson ever do anyways?
Well, in other news this week, the Independent Journal Review, a news and opinion website geared towards conservative millennials, posted a study by the First Liberty Institute, a right-leaning advocacy group that claims attacks on religious liberty in the United States have increased 133% in the last 5 years.
Oh boy, Brian. So my spidey senses are tingling.
There's only one Mormon reference in the piece, a quote by fellow Mormon and Utah Senator Mike Lee, who, quote, called the recent attacks on Christian beliefs strange and disturbing.
So while it's just a brief Mormon reference, depending on the LDS Church's priesthood priorities, or basically the language they use to qualify their focuses on social issues, this could gain traction in some Mormon circles, or it might not.
Doesn't it feel like just last year the LDS Church was talking ad nauseum about religious freedom? This seems to play exactly into some of the fears that many have. And I think that we should be careful about that pendulum swinging too wildly in any direction. Of course, the rights of religious people should be protected. Religious freedom is a very real thing. At the same time, we need to be making sure that the rights of either non-religious or those of different religious traditions are represented as well.
Brian, let me read to you from the introduction of the study under the heading of "The Time for Denialists Past" to give some context as to what's in this study. Quote, "To deny that religious freedom is in crisis is to deny the obvious. And yet there are deniers. Ironically, they include those who launched the very attacks that have caused the crisis itself. The American people, however, deserve the truth," end quote. I'm going to be honest with you guys. That's some very inflammatory language. And if the First Liberty Institute is, as the Independent Journal Review described them, a right-leaning advocacy group, I think there deserves to be a good amount of skepticism regarding their study.
Brant, would it surprise you if some religious rights have been infringed?
No, look, Brian, not at all. And would it surprise you if there was another report that came out 1 month from now that showed that different areas of religion seem to infringe on others' rights?
Oh, I'm totally with you. And I think that's the crux of the issue. These reports are good, but it's just as good to do the hard reading and go through 420 pages to see exactly what the issues the report discusses actually are in order to make your own determination. I mean, I don't want to be completely cynical, but everyone has an angle nowadays.
Look, Brian, I think you're being nicer than I am, okay? I will be completely cynical. I don't think cynicism or skepticism is a bad thing because it forces you to look closer and deeper at the issue. If there's valid data here, the data will stand. However, as we've said with so many stories like these, it's going to be used as a conversation ender rather than a point of further discussion, research, and analysis. Hey, that sounds very similar to a topic that we're going to talk about.
Not yet, Brant. Patience. We're going to get to that.
Okay. All right. Fine. Okay. What else is going on? Do we have any updates this week on hurricanes?
As a matter of fact, there were, Brant. It's amazing how in sync our minds are, like we planned this out or something.
Gasp, shock, the sound of a shelf breaking, et cetera, et cetera.
President Henry B. Eyring visited the Caribbean to see the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, along with Bishop Dean M. Davies of the Presiding Bishopric and General Authority 70 Elder George Klebengat. I always get stuck with the difficult to pronounce General Authority names, Brant.
Isn't that interesting? I don't know who would have done that. You know, we might need the church to produce a pronunciation guide just to help us through some of that. President Eyring said, quote, "The rebuilding of some of these places may take years. When you lose infrastructure, it takes a long time to put it back. I don't know what part we'll play in that, but we ought to be as helpful as we can to the government agencies that are responsible. We can't do it all, but we can help wherever we can," end quote. End of the day, look, this is good Christian living. It should come as no surprise that when disaster strikes, the LDS Church is there.
But you know where the LDS Church won't be? Involved with HBO and that new show, Room 104.
HBO's new fall series, Room 104, which focuses on a motel and the people inside of them, focused on Mormon missionaries this last week. Slash Film covered the episode, and in what was my biggest worry, they say the episode focused on these missionaries who completely rethink their lives and purpose, and they, quote, "embark on their own version of Rumspringa, only to be conflicted the next day as to their path forward."
I mean, this really should come as no surprise. Mormons are featured on HBO, and I can't imagine it's going to be something that you're going to want to talk about at church or, you know, show at a ward fireside. The cliche of a budding romance between two serving missionaries might, interestingly enough, have a strangely popular market on Amazon, but it's more of a reflection of the outlier than the norm for Mormon missionaries.
But Brian, you know, can I give them just a little bit of credit? Just a little bit. It's another in the growing saga of the American public and their increasing comfort with Mormons and with our unique culture. The episode didn't start with a thorough background on Mormon missionary rules or what the young men were doing on missions or the formation of the church or Joseph Smith or anything like that, right? There was this understanding that everyone kind of knows the white shirts and ties and the rules and what all that means. The director for this episode, Megan Griffith, seemed to take a few extremes and explore them a bit more. And while this definitely isn't presented as the norm for missionaries, I think it does provide some interesting ground to explore a few of those themes.
Now, look, it's not like either of us are recommending that you go watch this episode. It's really, it's not for everybody. But it's definitely a non-traditional look at Mormon missionaries, and I think it's less about the missionaries and more about faith and dogma and its place in the world while using Mormon and missionaries as a recognizable backdrop.
Which is a very interesting way of showing something, and I think it's something that we're going to see more and more. But Brian, speaking of the Mormons, well, wait, that transition wasn't nearly as professional as yours.
Practice makes perfect, Brent.
All right, I'll try it. Anyways, fellow Mormon rocker Brandon Flowers was interviewed by Rolling Stone, and wouldn't you know it, his Mormonism came up.
Rolling Stone asked him what he thought the biggest misimpression of Mormonism was, and Flower answered, "There is this kind of weird mystery around it. With Christianity, you have 2,000 years of separation from when the events took place, and these, you know, supposed miracles. We don't have that much separation from Joseph Smith in the 1800s and the other events that we believe took place. So it's a lot easier to home in on it. People that knew Moses didn't keep journals, but we actually have that information."
You know, Brian, that's a surprisingly rational take.
And it's something that we've talked about quite a bit.
And here I was thinking he was going to be the next disaffected online Mormon darling. Well, moving on.
So Elder Jeffrey R. Holland spoke at a three-day Second Windsor Conference on Religious Persecution at Windsor Castle on September 9th, joined by Sister Sharon Eubank, First Counselor in the Relief Society General Presidency and Director of LDS Charities.
If that conference sounds familiar, it was the same he spoke at last year when he spoke on the Mormon experience as refugees in 19th century America. This year's topic was very intriguing. Quote, "The church's move from persecution to integration with its gradual emergence out of religious obscurity."
Of course, being a pioneer is not easy. It requires an inner strength for which many aspire, but few achieve. For Latter-day Saints, this inner strength comes from the conviction deep in their hearts that what they believe is true. And that conviction is the strength not only to endure, but to prevail.
This conference was very touching as it focused on the Yazidis, an ancient minority religion in northern Iraq who have been targeted by ISIS, have been abused and tortured, and the United Nations has described their experience as genocide.
The MR Foundation hosted this conference, and MR Chair and Founder Baroness Emma Nicholson invited Elder Holland to speak at this year's conference because she wanted him to focus on the Mormon experience of returning from exile and gradual assimilation into the American mainstream.
As a matter of fact, Nicholson said, "How to turn around, walk proud, stop being seen as a victim, and become successful, that's the Mormon experience. It's a teaching experience from the Mormons as a gift to the refugees of the world, and that's why I asked them to come."
A very cool thing. So, Brian, is it time?
Yes, it's time.
Oh, yeah. Let's get ready for the great gay cakeoff.
Oh, my gosh, Brett. You've been waiting all show to say that, haven't you?
It's been so hard to keep quiet, and I am like giddy with excitement to get into this.
You must be so proud of yourself.
I'm beaming, Brian.
Okay, look, there's a case on the Supreme Court docket for the 2017 term involving Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. The case centers on whether creative businesses can refuse service due to its First Amendment rights of free speech and the free exercise of religion in light of public accommodations laws, in particular by refusing to participate in same-sex marriage ceremonies on the basis of one's religious belief.
Oh yeah, we're talking legalese, people. Let's keep it all under control here, okay? I know you're excited. In a report from Fox 13 in Salt Lake City, 22 of 24 members of the United States Senate's Republican Majority Caucus, Republican Senator Mike Lee and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints signed an amicus brief in support of the Baker.
So the filing states, amici are Utah Republican state senators who support compromise between LGBT protections and religious liberties. In 2015, against then prevailing political currents, supermajorities in Utah's GOP-controlled legislature added sexual orientation and gender identity to state anti-discrimination laws after stakeholders carefully balanced LGBT safeguards with religious liberties. This, quote, Utah compromise brought together LGBT organizations and faith groups with the mutual goal of achieving fairness for all in state employment and housing laws.
As a matter of fact, Troy Williams, the executive director of the LGBTQ rights group Equality Utah, said, quote, "If the LDS Church and the Utah legislation don't want the courts to decide something like public accommodations, that's awesome. Let's get together this January at the Utah legislature and start working together to pass a law that protects everybody.
In Utah Senate Majority Whip Stuart Adams, Republican from Layton, who sponsored the infamous Utah Compromise Bill, SB 296, for those of you who are keeping track at home, said, "In my opinion, the business simply says that they would give service to everyone, but because of their deep-seated religious beliefs, they have a challenge trying to actually balance those two. We need to find a way for the business to give that service, but allow the individuals to be able to step off and follow their conscience."
Now, Brian, you and I are not lawyers.
Yeah, far from it.
And I don't think we have the intellectual chops to really dissect the merits of the amicus brief and what it all means in context of the Supreme Court case.
Yeah, you know, we're kind of lightweights.
But you know what? Let's go ahead and give it the old college try.
If nothing else, we're confident.
Okay, so let's get this out of the way first. I totally understand where the initial shock might come when you see the LDS Church dipping its toe into the waters of LGBTQ legislation. Prop 8 in 2008 still stings for many, many people. The lobbying in opposition to the Obergefell federal same-sex marriage court hurt a lot of people. I don't deny that. And seeing this amicus brief might feel a little bit like PTSD, and I don't say that lightly. I know some people who are having some traumatic episodes from seeing this and seeing this happen again and thinking, well, here we go again.
But at the same time, we should play fair. Senate Bill 296, the Utah Compromise, was not only monumental in repairing some of those damages, but was even used as an example. In fact, example after example, when different states failed at their own legislation for equality. I'm looking at you, Indiana. And we can't deny that the church's statement regarding the LGBTQ benefit concert, the Love Loud concert, also did a lot to mend some of those wounds.
If there's one thing I've learned from attempting to follow some of these cases as they hit the Supreme Court as an amateur and as someone who is not a lawyer, is that once you put the emotion of the issue aside, the reason the case is in front of the Supreme Court is because it's complex and because it's messy.
Yeah, and frankly, nobody else wants to touch it.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, that's what blogger and First Amendment lawyer Carolyn Homer wrote at By Common Consent. Quote, "In Masterpiece Cake Shop, the baker has set up a delightfully complex web of competing facts that make the First Amendment analysis exceptionally difficult. He is not claiming a general right to refuse service to LGBTQ individuals. He is fine if customers buy off-the-shelf cookies and pies or ask him to custom make birthday cakes. What he is uncomfortable with is designing a bespoke wedding cake to celebrate a ceremony that violates his religious beliefs."
Yeah, and she continues, "Reasonable people can and vigorously do disagree about the best result here. The custom-made nature of the cake is, in my view, hugely significant. Precisely because the Constitution forbids slavery, an enormous body of law says that you can't force people to perform personal services against their will. And inherently artistic, subjective, client-focused, highly tailored services, things like photography and painting and cake decorating and wedding planning, they're the epitome of that body of law. You can turn down customers for a million reasons in these fields. Should a religious disagreement really be any different?"
Look, there are two sides to this argument. And if we try and do anything at the Mormon News Report, you know, outside of being snarky, it's to present both sides.
I mean, personally, I'm inclined towards the don't be a jerk rule, but I recognize that don't be a jerk is not what drives our laws. It's not illegal to be a jerk. The bottom line is, should you be sued over refusing to participate in something that you fundamentally disagree with? Should, you know, for example, a Muslim singer worry about being sued if she turns down a job singing at a Christian wedding?
And some people have also made the comparison of whether a Christian business owner should have the right to refuse service to a Mormon on the grounds of religious differences, or whether a white nationalist should be able to sue a bakery over refusing to make swastika cookies.
You know, I mean, and to be fair, some of these analogies get a little out of hand. I mean, to compare a gay wedding to a hate group is a bit of a stretch. I see what people are driving at. I just don't think that those comparisons are very helpful.
And I would additionally add, Brian, the problem with a lot of those comparisons is a lot of people making those comparisons aren't lawyers. And when lawyers jump in, they seem to start to go through and say, that doesn't apply there and it doesn't apply there. And I think that's the problem. We're trying to contextualize this in language that we understand, but it becomes very difficult. And in the end, we're talking about protected classes versus free speech. Race, religion, gender, age, and disabilities are all protected classes. I can only imagine the conversation we'd be having if this baker had refused to make a wedding cake based on the client's race or disability, if they had refused a marriage because it was mixed race, or refused to bake a cake for someone on the autism spectrum or someone in a wheelchair. We would be outraged.
Yeah, yes, we would, which is why freedom of speech is only one part of this conversation. Sexual orientation is a partially protected class, and as long as freedom of religion is a driving force behind these laws, then sexual orientation will always remain a vulnerable demographic. And that's where this whole thing gets really dicey with the church's involvement in this amicus brief.
I think there's two things going on here. We have the legality of the issue and we have the ethics of the issue. And when you have the legality of an issue versus the ethics of an issue, it makes it very difficult to discuss. The ethics say you should make the damn cake. But legally, it gets really messy. And that's why this issue is really hard to discuss, because the legal side tries to strip away the ethics and the emotion of the situation. And to be honest, that's no fun when you sit there and go, well, all of your righteous feelings or you know, indignation or whatever you want to call it, that doesn't matter because we're looking at the core emotionless legality of the issue.
And look, we can sit here and say that we support anti-discrimination legislation. We can support fundraising and public awareness efforts like the Love Loud concert that we talked about. We can make public statements that we support LGBTQ brothers and sisters, but those limits are always reached when it comes down to marriage.
And when anything threatens to legally compel small business owners to accommodate wedding ceremonies that they personally disagree with on religious grounds, well, that's when the church's lawyers start thinking about the potential long-term ramifications that compelled accommodation could have on the church's policies and practices. And when you peel away all of the layers of the church's religious freedom campaign, that's what it really boils down to: maintaining the freedom to refuse performing or accepting same-sex marriages without the potential for lawsuits. That's what it has always been about from the beginning of the church's efforts to oppose same-sex marriage. I'm not saying the church shouldn't have this right, but like we said earlier, what would this conversation look like if we were talking about interracial marriage or any other protected class? And Brian, I will say this. The problem that I have with everything that's going on with this situation is I don't think we live in an environment right now where we can have a conversation like you and I are having, where we get down into the messy details of things. Because that's where this conversation really should be going, is looking at it from all these different sides like we're doing, where we're talking about mixed race marriages or disabilities or religious beliefs that might not be traditionally Christian or whatever. And that's the problem with this whole thing. As a matter of fact, there are plenty of other podcasts out there, right? And there's a great podcast called Intelligence Squared US, where they take complex issues like this and they try and have a rational debate with supporters on either side. I'd love for them to take this on. But you know what? I don't know what I don't want to see people take this on. I don't want to see people on Twitter and Facebook take this on. Because for every armchair lawyer who's watched an episode or two of Law and Order and thinks that they know everything about the law, they cannot strip away the ethics and the emotion of the issue versus the legality. So what am I going to do? I'm going to wrap it up and say that's about the extent of my thoughts on this. It's complex and it's messy, and I'm going to defer to experts because I want to hear what they have to say. But before we all start going out there grabbing our pitchforks, let's take a step back and let's try and at least understand, because the big question I want to ask to many people who are already spouting out their opinions, have you read the amicus brief? Because the amicus brief is like 50 pages long and it's not easy legal reading. And once people start doing that, and once people are prepared to have a discussion, not on the ethics of the issue, but on the legality of the issue, that's when I'm interested in having that conversation.
Cake is messy, Brent, and so is this issue. And we'll be back with Max Mueller.
If you're looking for more current news coverage on Mormonism, why don't you try the Mormon News Report? The Mormon News Report is a weekday email sent hot and fresh to your inbox every day by 9 a.m. covering the top stories in Mormonism with just a tiny bit of snark. Our focus is on actual news from actual newspaper and reporters covering all aspects of Mormonism. If you're interested in signing up, email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com with your name and zip code. We use that for demographic purposes. You could like the Mormon News Report on Facebook. You could find us on Twitter at The Mormon News, or visit theculturalhall.com/Mormon-news-report for more information.
Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. This I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, love and marriage, it's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry and they will say it's elementary. Try
We'd like to welcome onto the show Max Perry Mueller. Max is an assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Nebraska and author of Race and the Making of the Mormon People from University of North Carolina Press. Max received a master's in theological studies from the Harvard Divinity School and completed his PhD from Harvard in 2015. Get ready for this, everyone. His dissertation was the foundation for his book on race and Mormonism, and there are a few folks on his dissertation committee that regular listeners of the Mormon News Report podcast and our old podcast, This Month in Mormon Studies, will recognize, notably our friend Laurel Thasher Ulrich and David Holland. Max was also the 2015 winner of the Mormon History Association Best Dissertation Award and the 2014 winner of the Award for Excellence Journal article for Playing Jane, Representing Black Mormon Memory Through Reenacting the Black Mormon Past, and the 2012 MHA winner for Best Graduate People. Whoa. Max, I think we got a lot to talk about, so welcome to the show.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks very much for having me.
So let's start with some of the basics here. Sure. This is a very unique subject, and we're talking about it a lot recently. So what got you into the study of the history of race and Mormonism?
So I'm sitting in the CHL, the Church History Library, doing my research. And often the senior missionaries are often, why are you here, Max? But you're not a member of the church. So I have a very distinct, I'm not a Mormon, but story. And then I'll talk a little bit about why I'm interested in also questions of race. So I grew up, actually, I was born in Casper, Wyoming. So this return to Nebraska in some ways is a return to the Great Plains, and along the Mormon Trail. And when I was growing up, this is a little bit confessional, but it's also part of the story here. My parents were having an acrimonious divorce, but across the street was a Mormon family, a really welcoming Mormon family, and I would kind of sneak over there and hang out with their wonderful family and play with their kids and have dinners when things weren't so copacetic at my own household. So in all honesty, that experience really helped me, really endeared me to the Mormon people, and especially the Mormon culture around the family. And so I've always really have been fascinated with kind of the origins of that particular culture. I wanted to explore Mormonism basically ever since that point, whether it was in college or later in graduate school. It's also an excuse. I'm a skier, so studying Mormonism, to be honest, is an opportunity to get back to Utah and do some skiing. So, and Mormonism, even from that early age, I detected a sense of, I'm going to be careful with this term, but kind of like the white ethnic other, right? And that Mormons represent, whether it's the tribe, kind of the insularity, the tribalism that Mormonism, is famous for, infamous for. Certainly, as my experience showed, as the Ward Houses says, all are welcome. That really holds true, especially for those seeking kind of safety and succor at hard times. As Paul Reeve has so masterfully described this kind of the white ethnic, the origins of the white Mormon ethnic, and so I detected that the lines crossing between race and religion there in the white Mormon community, but even on the white Mormon body, right? I always talk about kind of having Mormon dar, looking around and detecting kind of those symbolisms or their signifiers of what makes, if I can detect a Mormon walking down the street, the way they hold themselves, the kind of dress.
Kind of a big smile, things like that.
A big smile. Exactly. A big smile, well put together, shaven. No. Those kind of things. But I also have also been really fascinated with questions of race. Again, this is a little bit confessional, but we scholars too often find our interest, in our own histories. And this is family history. My first step family, my mother got remarried twice, but anyway, the first family, the older sibling, my only person with whom I would, spent any time as a kid or another sibling was a guy named Jason Rothenberg, and he changed his name to Jason Reyes. He's actually was at one point a very famous and successful Broadway star. He was the first Lion King on the Broadway production of The Lion King, and he was 20 years old when he got that role after actually playing, fittingly enough, Pontius Pilate and then Judas on the last touring company of Jesus Christ Superstar. But Jason was a very light-skinned, mixed-race adopted kid, adopted by a set of Jewish kind of intellectuals, and was really, he always struggled with his racial identity, his religious identity. You know, I was seventh and eighth grade when he and I lived together, and I watched him conk his hair. He was very, and I didn't know what conking hair was, but, you know, he was very concerned about kind of both his Judaism, right? He changed his name from Rothenberg to Raiz, R-A-I-Z-E, and also his blackness. And so I was always fascinated, right, as an outsider, as a someone watching, whether it were the Mormons or my stepbrother, they're kind of navigate kind of the racial and religious world, complicated racial and religious worlds of America. So yeah, so in this project allowed me in some ways to put the two kind of fascinations together. And really, as I tell kind of in the beginning of the book, or in the acknowledgments of the book, on my honeymoon, dragged my wife to Salt Lake on our way up to Jackson Hole. And at This Is the Place Heritage Park, I found Kate B. Carter's really seminal work, The Story of the Negro Pioneer. And Jane Manning James's story is the longest in there. And really that got me started on, she's just such a fascinating and fascinating and powerful story of resilience, deep faith, levels of self-negation, and if we value the black self in this culture, right? But also, deep respect for her own self and the power of her ability to kind of articulate a place in this Mormon culture that really didn't want to have her as a member, at least when she died.
So, Max, if I could really quick, that first part of your book, it actually was quite endearing to me, mostly because I've done that to my wife on so many occasions. And so I'm reading this going, I'm not the only one that does this. I'm not the only weirdo that drags my family to these random, nuggets of Mormon history that I'm interested in. So basically what I'm saying is you and I have kindred spirits, and you have my full support if you ever want to take your wife to any of those things.
Okay. But maybe not my wife's.
Well, and Max, digging in a little bit here with your discovery of Jane Manning James's autobiographical work. Well, somewhat autobiographical, right? You had mentioned in your introduction that this was the first major study of race and Mormonism that foregrounds the experiences of non-white Mormons. And I have to tell you that, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the more contemporary historiography on the subject here. Sure. But as a lead into that, I have to tell you, that's something I've never really even noticed. And and if that doesn't define white privilege, is the fact that I've never really even noticed that we have not centered these stories from the perspective of non-white Mormons. But, there's been a lot of discussion about Mormonism and race recently. You'd mentioned Paul Reeve, and he had his MHA award-winning book in his last year, 2015, about Mormons being viewed as a separate race. Then there was like Russell Stevenson's MHA award-winning book on international Black Mormons. We've got the University of Utah's Black, White, and Mormon conference last year. You got Newell Bringhurst and was it Matt Harris, who's recently done the documentary history. And one of the things that I'm seeing here is a trend is that a lot of these end up winning awards. Sure. So maybe you're, hey, that's probably, you're probably in a position.
Let me just run. We mentioned Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. Her book also, her House Full of Females also came out this year. So
right. Yeah, you're up against some pretty stiff competition, right?
But yes, but
But there may be some other categories too.
Right? Sure.
But at any rate, I guess my question is with this contemporary historiography on race and Mormonism, can you just get into a little bit of, I guess, 2-point questions? Number one, a little bit more of what separates your work from what's been put out in the past, let's say, 5 years. And also where you think the discussion of race and Mormonism is different now than it was, say, 20 years, Lester Bush's era and, Newell Bringhurst's era.
Sure. So let me answer that second one first, if I may. Really, the question, and it was a natural question to grapple with. Historiography often follows kind of a natural pattern of kind of answering perhaps for communities. And I mean, communities, both religious communities and also scholarly communities, and Newell and Lester Bush, they represent, they're part of both of those in terms of questions around race and Mormonism.
And Armand Moss,
of course, and his really important sociological work in some ways, my book in some ways is for different reasons, perhaps most importantly, that we're not just simply talking about the black-white binary. In some ways, my book is in the lineage of Armin Mass's work a little bit more. So the main question was, for those scholars, the kind of 20 years, 30 years ago, and even actually longer, was trying to figure out the origins of the, you know, what we in both, you know, both scholars of Mormonism and Mormons themselves use as the catch-all phrase, the priesthood ban. And that's a problematic term because the ban wasn't just on potential priesthood holders, meaning male, black, you know, people of African, males of African descent. It was also meant excluded female members of African descent from important spaces and important duties within Mormon culture, namely the temple. Anyway, so there was an effort to solve that problem. Where did this begin? In part, it was I would argue it came out of and this is tricky both from Lester and Newell's now kind of personal faith convictions, but at least initially I know for Lester, it came out of a conviction of trying to actually find continuity, not change. It was a belief that actually Mormonism in its essence, and I think a lot of Mormons feel this, is a faith, as it says in 2 Nephi 26:33, right? Is that correct? 26:33, all are alike unto God. Is a faith of universality, especially on questions of race. And they were trying to establish, hey, there was a time, clearly, they were looking for a time in the past when there were members, black members of the church who were welcomed as such by Joseph Smith himself. And so they were looking for a time when when the church did welcome people of African descent as members, and then what the kind of mechanisms, the historical mechanisms that led to that change. So that was a focus, understandable focus of that early scholarship. They were trying to locate really the importance of continuity, finding a time when people of African descent were members, so that in the future, and Lester Bush and Newell Bringers were working doing their research before the 1978 revelation, in the hopes that in the future, once the priesthood ban is eradicated, we can point to actually this is a restoration, right, of the original universal claims of Mormonism. So it's both trying to locate that change, but also in doing so, argue for a continuity of Mormonism, right? So that's why, Elijah Abel's stories and Jane Manning James's stories are so important to both those scholars, but also contemporary Mormons, especially Mormons of African descent, because the argument they can make, and I've argued it elsewhere, especially the folks who reenact Jane Manning James's autobiography, that they're arguing for the aberration was the period when people of African descent were banned. That's the aberration that should not have been. So that's the kind of that natural question had to be solved. Today, I think my book is able to do based on this, all that scholarship and Paul Reeves' scholarship and others, is it start looking at race as a more larger phenomenon, move away from the black-white binary on which most racial discussions in the United States remain trapped, and understand race as something that actually does not start actually on the body of racialized peoples, but starts elsewhere in telling stories, in particular religious stories, right? What are the religious origins of these various races that we, as Americans, came to name and therefore name and lead to division? So I think that's the main difference, is that my work is now able, based on that previous work, because some of those questions were answered, able to look, step back even farther and not just look at kind of solving these internal questions, historical questions, but place race and Mormonism in a larger American content.
So let me ask you this. Mormonism has obviously a fraught history with race. You sure. Document that in your book, and you went through a few other areas that the scholars and historians have documented that. Mm-hmm. But you also said in the beginning of the interview that you talked with senior missionaries at the Church Historians Library. Sure. What was their reaction when you told them, hey guys, I'm digging into your history on race? I mean, obviously you didn't say it that way, but I've got to imagine that, I don't know, were they defensive at all, or how did they feel about that?
Yeah, understandably, mostly they were curious. First of all, they were happy. Here's the thing about hanging out at any archive, but in particular one that where people of faith are the, in some ways at least the initial gatekeepers, right? They appreciate someone who's earnest, someone who's trying to be fair, someone who's curious, and someone who's respectful of their faith. And I had many conversations about, you know, I quickly disabused them of the notion, I hope, that I was trying to prove that Mormons are fundamentally racist, or the Book of Mormon itself is fundamentally a white supremacy foundational text, though there are certainly aspects of it that are that reflect those theologies.
Max, was that a concern that they had? Was that was you're coming in there with an agenda like that?
Yes, in some cases, and they were politic and didn't ever question me explicitly on that. But they were understandably concerned or curious, wary of someone coming in who's not a member of their church and who might be bringing in stereotypes, you know, to that he's trying to actually prove as fact, right? Because these are actually stereotypes, of course, have kernels of truth in them, but they certainly only represent one slice of the of truth. Mormonism has a very troubling past. I'll call it. Mormon has a racist past, right? And at the same time, that's only one slice. Even at the most racist points in the church's history, there isn't one Mormonism, right? There are many people arguing for inclusion. There are many non-white Mormons trying to carve out places for themselves within the church. So it's a much richer, you know, that's what I discovered. It's a much richer story than a declension narrative away from, you know, what, you know, the kind of utopian vision that Jane Manning James tries to paint for us in her autobiography of the Nauvoo Mansion House, where she's welcomed as a full member of the community, you know, towards some kind of declension away from that kind of utopia, racial utopia, where Joseph Smith throws open the doors and even says, white brothers and sisters, you, because our living quarters are cramped tonight, you all are going to sleep together in the same rooms, as she describes, and without batting an eye and not without worrying about the racial trouble that might present, especially in the 1840s, you know, declining away from that to some kind of Mormonism as a white, you know, a faith of white supremacy by the time she dies. That's not the story, even with James's own history. So, and the missionaries, I quickly realized that was not my purpose, especially when I was particularly interested in highlighting Jane Manning James and other and Native American Mormons who were faithful members of the church or who had complicated relationships with the church, right, as Native Americans in a lot of cases did. So they realized that I was particularly interested in telling Mormon stories, not my own story, hopefully not my own story, not my own agenda.
Yeah, with a couple of minutes that we have left here with you, there's some points in there that you hit on that I think are thematically centralized in your book. And let me explain here. So you wrote in the introduction, you wrote that the construction of race was a literary project as much as it was a literal one. And, you know, you discuss the Book of Mormon as being central to understanding this issue of race, and what you call the white universal gospel of Mormonism. So I'm going to have you talk a little bit about the white universal gospel, particularly how whiteness was seen as an aspirational race as opposed to a genetic race, because I think that's a key central theme throughout your book. But more so, I agree with you, Max, when you say that the Book of Mormon has been somewhat dismissed in past historical readings of this, and it seems like it's always been put as an aside. We have this assumption that early Mormons were more artifactually interested in the Book of Mormon than they were textually or content-wise interested in the Book of Mormon. And you flip that on its head, and you say, no, if you really look at you know, early Times and Seasons documents, for instance, and the newspapers that were being spread out, they were theologically getting into certain points of the Book of Mormon, and you can see this progression where it goes, you know, more and more towards race. So I just want you to spend your last couple of minutes talking about this white Mormon, this white universal gospel, and this aspiration of whiteness, and how the Book of Mormon influenced that reading, if you don't mind.
So one thing I back up and say, whiteness, this is tricky, and I hesitate to even say this, but whiteness is not race. right, in the Book of Mormon. And I don't even think whiteness necessarily means race in the larger American construct. Whiteness in the Book of Mormon, and I would say the Bible itself, is the empty racial category. It's the non-race. Whiteness in the Book of Mormon, whiteness and blackness in the Book of Mormon are only come into existence when family members sin against the family for which they are punished, which they're cursed. And that curse manifests explicitly, right? It's not subtext as it is in the Bible. It's text in the Book of Mormon as a racial demarcation. So, for example, and I see this direct, this is what we call intertextuality with the Bible and how it kind of reverberates in the Book of Mormon. So Cain sin against Abel, right? That's a pretty darn big sin against the family, right? The first history's first murder. Then after the flood, Ham sin against Noah, his very kind of interesting, hard to decipher exactly what the sin was, and Noah's curse against Ham's descendants, Canaan, to be servants of servants, separates those lineages, right? Lineages from the rest of the human family. And they're marked off. There's a mark in the Bible described. History, well, in the 16th and 17th century in particular, theologians and slave traders read race into the biblical story, right? Saying, oh, that, you know, Ham's descendants and Cain's descendants are Africans, and therefore they're doomed to be servants of servants. In the Book of Mormon, it's more explicit. When Laman and his crew sin, you know, rise up or murmur against Nephi, they are cursed with blackness. So whiteness is the standard race. It's the non-race. It's the original race. Only does whiteness come into existence when sin occurs, right? So that tells us something. So the origins of race, therefore, are narrative. They're not biological. They are narrative. So then those stories need to be told before race comes into existence. The powerful message of the Book of Mormon is that the whole message of the Book of Mormon, and there are various points within the Book of Mormon that, you know, we don't probably have a lot of time to get into, but after Christ's visit to the New World, after a period of time, the Nephites and Lamanites disappear. There are no more ites, right? So because of faith. So the promise of the white universal gospel is that race is not permanent. Race is not God's design. Race enters into human history when one set of the human family sins against the other. And it can be overcome, therefore, it's not permanent. It can be overcome by continuing the story, by completing the story and returning to the faith of the original faith of the forefathers. And so that's the promise that's in the Book of Mormon. And that is what, to use J. Manning James's, you know, the most important figure in my book, but that's what she was told by Hiram Smith in her first patriarchal blessing before he was assassinated, along with his brother, that if she returns to the faith of more, you know, she returns to the original faith, that God could remove the stamp of, I mean, this is in the patriarchal blessing. I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, but the key that creates the times and changes the seasons can remove the stamp upon your forehead, and he can stamp upon his own lineage upon you. And Jane Manning James held to that belief to the point where at the end of her life, she says, I am white with the exception of the color of my skin. She thought she demonstrated that white universal gospel or participated in it to the point where she could overcome the accursedness of her ancestors, her black ancestors, and part with them and reconnect herself with the original family. So that's that's my unpacking of the Book of Mormon, if that followed. In terms of the Book of Mormon briefly, the Book of Mormon and its influence on the early church, you know, the Evening and Morning Star is full of Book of Mormon passages. And in fact, I read them as reading guides to the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon famously did not sell well, or at least not to the expectations of the early printers and purveyors of it. But the Evening and Morning Star was widely read both by Mormons and non-Mormons. You know, just look at any of the Mormons' enemies. Boy, they are carefully parsing the Book of Mormon. So that shows us that the Book of Mormon was read in that you know, between 1830 and 1833, especially on these questions of race. And we can look to the enemies, the Mormons' enemies, who understood that, boy, this gospel could threaten to overturn the racial hierarchy of slavery, of relationships with Native Americans. They understood the radicalness of this foundational text.
Well, we're out of time for this segment, but, you know, we'd love to chat with you for a little bit longer. Do you have a few more minutes that you can stick around?
Absolutely. Sure. Happy to talk.
You can find Max's new book, Race and the Making of the Mormon People, at Amazon.com, local Utah area bookstores, through the University of North Carolina Press, and anywhere that you find books. Max, thanks so much, and we will be back in just a second for our Patreon listeners.
Apologetics can be defined as a defense of faith through argumentation. Christian apologetics comprise some of the earliest forms of Christian writings. Throughout the centuries, apologists have argued for the reality of God, legitimacy of Scripture, the creation, the fall, the preeminence of grace, and the eschatology of the end times. Adding to these, Mormon apologists have defended Joseph Smith's first vision, the embodiment of God, continuing revelation, extra-biblical scripture and temple rituals, among other topics, and have reached new levels of sophistication through training in fields such as history, philosophy, and Near Eastern languages and culture. Through multiple perspectives, the contributors to this volume explore the textures and contours of apologetics, revealing deep ideological fissures within the Mormon studies community concerning its utility. In spite of these deep-seated differences, what each author has in common is a passion for Mormonism and how it is presented and defended. This volume captures that reality and allows readers to encounter the terrain of Mormon apologetics at close range. Learn more about perspectives on Mormon theology, apologetics, by visiting gregcoford.com.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by our friends at todayinmormonhistory.com. On September 12, 1852, Parley P. Pratt preaches, "At what speeds would the saints travel? We are told that light is the power that governs all things. If the saints travel as fast as light, they would go at the rate of 200,000 miles a second. God can go as fast as light, and he has made the saints. And I am led to conclude that they can travel as fast as light, for they have got to go on missions to far distant worlds. And if they do not go as fast as light, they would be a long time on their way, spending their time without doing any good."
You know, I mean, I feel like a lot of Mormons are already attempting to do this on I-15 in Utah.
Well, you know, it would certainly cut down on the work commute.
Yeah, but we'd still get to church late. And that's our show. We'd like to thank Max Mueller for being our guest. Remember to check out the Mormon News Report extended sessions on Patreon to hear our complete interview with him. Here's a clip.
Jane Manning James saw her life. I see the autobiography as her response to all those Mormons, especially in the hierarchies, who says, you cannot be a Mormon because you're black. Well, James is saying, no, look at my history. I did a pre-trek before you all were on a trek. I moved my family from Connecticut. I converted my whole family, moved them from Connecticut to join and hung out with Joseph. While I was with Joseph and Emma, Lucy Mack showed me the Urim and Thummim. I was an early witness to polygamy. So I hung out with Joseph and Hiram and the whole family. And then I was an 1847er. I raised this big family. I've been a faithful tithe-paying member, you know, my whole life. So I've demonstrated that I can be a Mormon, despite the color of my skin.
Just visit patreon.com and search Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a subscriber today.
We'd like to thank Scott Holmes for the music. Brian Whitney edited today's show. We'd especially like to thank you, our listeners. If you like what we're doing, please tell your friends about us.
And if you really want to help us out, please give us that review on iTunes. It only takes a few minutes, and it does make a huge difference.
Also, if you want to reach us directly, if you want to ask any probing questions to Brian that he will, of course, answer without editorial context, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. Until next week, we'll talk to you again after a while.